This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Grey Ghost by Clive Cussler and Robin Bursell. Read for you by Scott Brick. Prologue. Manchester, England, March 1906. Late for work, Reginald Oren raced across the street, the cobblestones slick from the night's rain. Dodging a horse and carriage, he jumped over a puddle, then ran toward a brick building that took up half a city block. He shrugged out of his overcoat, hung it on a hook just inside the door, and quietly entered a large workroom filled with a half dozen young men sitting at their desks, their attention focused on the office on the far side of the room. No one noticed that Reginald was late, and he took his seat, glancing toward the office's open door, where Charles Rolls and Henry Royce, both dressed in dark suits, were talking to a policeman. "That looks ominous," Reginald said, glancing over at his cousin Jonathan Peyton, who sat at the desk next to his. "What did I miss?"
"It's gone."
"What's gone?"
"The 4050 prototype."
"When?"
"Last night. They went there this morning to finish up the coachwork, and it was gone."
Reginald leaned back in his chair as he looked around the room, then focused on the men in the office, imagining what this would do to the company. Rolls-Royce Limited had put all their money and that of their investors into this improved six-cylinder engine. Every last penny had gone into the design of that, as well as a chassis meant to withstand the harsh country roads. When the world seemed to laugh at them, saying it couldn't be done, they'd persevered. And now, when they were on the verge of accomplishing the impossible... Jonathan leaned toward him, lowering his voice.
"Was Elizabeth pleased?"
"Pleased?" he said, unable to draw his gaze from the office. Reginald's wife, Elizabeth, had taken their newborn son to visit her mother, and for the life of him, he couldn't figure out why Jonathan would bring her up at a time like this.
"About what?"
"About the pianoforte."
A shame he couldn't hear what they were discussing in there, and he finally turned toward his cousin, belatedly recalling last night's conversation when he'd solicited Jonathan's assistance.
"Undoubtedly she will be. Meant to thank you for helping my friends and me move it, but you disappeared. One minute you were next to me, the next you were gone. But I guess I had a bit much. Not sure what happened."
He was quiet a moment, then whispered,
"You won't mention that to my father, will you?"
"Of course not."
Jonathan's father, Viscount Wellswick, had raised both boys after Reginald's parents died. Though Reginald always suspected he'd have ended up in an orphanage if not for the intervention of Jonathan's mother. Ironic, considering that she was the reason their fathers had been the bitterest of enemies. Reginald's father had been in love with her, but her fortune was needed to restore the viscountcy, so she was wedded to Jonathan's father instead. He often wondered if she regretted the marriage. Her husband, the Viscount, was frugal beyond belief, as well as a strict disciplinarian. He certainly wouldn't have approved of either of them spending a night at one of the local taverns, drinking ale with the neighborhood residents. The Viscount was all about propriety. How it would look to his friends if his son and nephew stepped out of line. Appearances were everything, which was why Reginald and Jonathan were expected to oversee the running of the orphanage that bore the Viscount's name. Jonathan, in line to be the next Viscount and heir to the Peyton estate, was expected to be there 6 days a week, usually stopping in after work. In Reginald's mind, that was the one advantage of being the poor relation living under his uncle's roof. He was only expected to volunteer his time at the orphanage twice a week. Of course, that was in addition to the 6 days a week both men spent working for Rolls-Royce. There were no free rides in the Peyton home, the old man thinking that working at a job each day built character. Had the Viscount discovered Reginald had led Peyton astray, he'd likely toss Reginald, his wife, and their son out on the street.
"Not to worry," Reginald said, turning his attention back to the office. "Your secret of drunken debauchery is safe with me."
Reginald watched the men talking in the office, the faces of the two owners, Rolls and Royce, looking drawn, the loss weighing on them. The stolen car, named the Grey Ghost for the color of the body and the quietness of the 4050 engine, had been kept a secret from all but their investors, for fear that someone might try to steal their ideas. Apparently, it had never occurred to them that someone might steal the entire car. Peyton's father, the Viscount, had offered the family warehouse to store the car while they were fitting it with its custom coachwork, hoping to enter it into the Olympia Motor Show in just a few months. Reginald and Jonathan had discussed the idea that the vehicle would be more secure there, less likely to fall prey to anyone skulking around the factory stealing plans. Jonathan, however, was the one who'd presented it. "Tough break this happening on your watch, don't you think?" Reginald said. "Quite. I expect they'll sack me for it. Have they said anything to you?" "No," Peyton whispered, his face paling as Mr. Rolls shook the officer's hand, then escorted him out the door. Mr. Royce stepped out after them, then looked right at Jonathan. "Do you have a moment?" "Right away, sir." Jonathan Peyton rose, not looking at his cousin as he walked toward the office. "Close the door." "Yes, sir." He shut the door behind him. Reginald eyed the journals on a cabinet against the wall near the office, casually walking over, picking up the topmost one, pretending to read it. The walls were thin enough to hear what was being said. "You've no doubt heard what happened," Mr. Royce asked Jonathan.
"I have."
"You realize what dire straits we're in?" Reginald leaned in closer. In charge of the books, he knew every penny the company spent and what would happen to their investors if they didn't recover that car and start turning a profit. They'd go bankrupt. His uncle, the Viscount, who'd invested everything right along with them. Jonathan's response, though, was covered by the return of Mr. Rolls, who nearly ran into Reginald as he came back from seeing the officer out. "Pardon," Mr. Rolls said, stepping past him. He started to open the door, paused, looking over at Reginald and then the other young men sitting at their desks, their attention on what was happening in the office. "I dare say we're all frightfully worried over this setback, but we'll get past it. In the meantime, let's all get back to our tasks, shall we?" The young men nodded, as did Reginald, and their employer gave a worried smile, then entered the office. "This is disastrous," he said, pushing the door closed. It didn't latch tight. "We have to find that engine."
"Why would anyone bother?" Mr. Royce asked. "The blasted coachwork wasn't even finished."
"What do you think?" Rolls replied. "Sending spies sniffing around, trying to best us? Whoever it was, they stole it because they couldn't build anything close to what we have. Problem is, it's still in the prototype stage. If they get it out there before we do, we lose it all. Every investor we have will pull out."
"Good point."
"What if we lose the patent?" Rolls said. "We have to get that car back before the Olympia Motor Show."
"The policeman suggested we hire a detective."
Mr. Rolls made a scoffing noise.
"Not sure we want that to get out to our investors. Can't even keep track of our own products before they find their way into the hands of our competitors."
Jonathan Peyton started to speak, his voice cracking. He cleared his throat and started again, saying,
"What about those parts we sent out to be machined? If we could get them back in time, we might have a chance to finish that other 4050.
"Brilliant idea," Royce said. "They've got to be ready by now. Give them a ring, Peyton. If they're ready, see if they can't get them on the next train. We might just save this company after all."
1 week later. Just before sunrise, 10-year-old Toby Edwards and his 9-year-old brother Chip picked their way down the street, avoiding the low spots where the rain flowed down from the previous day's storm. They stopped at the entrance to the alley.
"Wait here," Toby said, moving his brother into the shadows. "I'll be back soon." "Why can't I go? I'll be quiet as a mouse."
"Just wait. If anything happens, run back."
The boy nodded and Toby moved off. The last time he'd stolen something from the bakery, he'd nearly gotten caught after stepping in a deep puddle. The water had soaked through his worn soles, his boots squeaking with every step he took. A customer was the one who'd heard, calling out to the baker that a thief had broken in, then chased after him. He wasn't about to make that mistake again. Worried the baker might catch him again, he'd stayed away for several days until hunger drove him out once more. This time, when he reached the back of the shop, he wiggled his toes, grateful that they seemed relatively dry. He glanced back, could just make out his brother in the dark. Satisfied he was waiting as he should, Toby moved in. The waiting was the hardest part. He breathed in the scent of fresh-baked bread drifting into the alley. Every morning the baker opened the back door a crack, just enough to let his gray tabby in and out. The door was locked tight, and Toby wondered if, after he'd nearly been caught, the man had realized it left him ripe for theft. Every minute that slipped by, Toby despaired. About to turn away, he heard the door open. The cat slipped out, its tiny paws silent on the wet cobblestones as it walked toward him, then rubbed its whiskered face against Toby's patched trousers. When the cat meowed loudly, Toby crouched beside it, petting the feline's head, feeling it purr against his fingertips. "Hush, you," he whispered, watching the door. Finally, he heard the faint tinkle from the bell that hung on the shop's front door, then the baker's deep voice, greeting whoever it was that had walked in. Usually it was the servants from the big manor houses that ventured out this early, those who didn't bake their own bread. Toby edged over, listening, before slipping into the door, immediately enveloped by the heat, wishing he could find a spot beneath the table to spend the night where he wouldn't be seen. To be that warm while he slept. Right now, food was more important. Suddenly he stopped, his heart sinking. The basket the baker had always left on the table with the burned and broken loaves wasn't there. The table was empty. His gaze flew to the door that led to the front of the shop, just able to make out the perfect loaves stacked in baskets on the counter. For a moment, he wondered how hard it would be to race out there, grab one, then keep running. He could never do that. It was one thing to take what was going to be tossed out. Quite another to brazenly steal something the baker made a living on. Stomach rumbling, he backed from the room, his foot hitting a wooden crate near the door. He froze, grateful when no one came racing into the kitchen. When he turned to leave, he saw what was in the wooden crate. Nearly a dozen rolls, the tops a bit too brown, the bottoms black as coal. Unable to believe his luck, he stuffed several rolls into his pockets, resisting the temptation to take every last one of them. Slipping out the door, he raced down the alley, pausing to grab his brother's arm. The two boys darted around the puddles, then out to the street, where massive brick warehouses lined the railroad tracks. Toby and Chip lived in the orphanage on the other side. After a quick glance behind him to make sure no one was following, Toby guided his brother that direction. When they reached the corner, he saw a man astride a black mare, champing at the bit. The horseman, struggling to keep his mount under control, looked their direction. Toby grasped Chip's hand, holding tight. Instinct told him to continue past as though that had been their intent the entire time. As soon as they were out of sight, they broke into a run. Up ahead, Toby saw an alcove and pulled his brother into it, hiding the boy behind him. A few seconds later, he heard the staccato clip of the horse's hooves on the cobblestones. Toby peered out, caught a glimpse of the man, and pressed back against the wall, praying the shadows would hide them.
"Who's that?" Chip asked.
"Quiet."
"I'm hungry,"
Chip whispered.
"And cold."
There was a familiarity about the man when he'd looked over at Toby, as though he'd seen him before. And this was what bothered Toby. Something told him that if he didn't find out who the man was, his brother and sisters wouldn't be safe. After their father, a coal miner, died of black lung disease, their mother had moved them all to Manchester, working in one of the textile mills. But then she'd taken ill too, and could no longer care for them. They'd lived the last year at the Peyton Home for Orphans. Had it not been for Toby's trips to the bakery, he and his siblings would have starved. He had to get back to his sisters, but the only way to the orphanage was across the tracks. Seconds ticked by, and the low rumble of an approaching train grew louder. Suddenly, the horseman turned and galloped back toward the tracks.
"Wait here," Toby said, tucking his brother safely in the shadows.
3 days ago, if someone had told Toby that he'd be brave enough to follow a horseman in the dark to see what the man was about, he might have laughed. He was the least brave person he knew. But his mother had made him promise to look after his sisters and brother. And that's exactly what he intended to do. He'd gone no more than a few feet when Chip appeared at his side. Toby backtracked, taking his brother's hand.
"I told you to wait. I don't want to stay by myself."
Toby considered taking him, until he remembered that feeling of terror when they'd almost been caught stealing from the bakery.
"Hold these for me,"
he said, pulling 3 of the 4 rolls from his pocket and helping his brother put them in his. When he pulled out the 4th roll, he held it up.
"If you stay here until I come back for you, I'll let you have the extra one."
Chip's eyes went wide as he stared at the burnt bread, but then he shook his head.
"If I have that, what'll you have?"
"I ate one in the kitchen before I got out," he said, hoping the rumble of his stomach wouldn't give him away.
"So hungry, I couldn't wait."
"But you want that extra one. You have to stay here."
"Why?"
"You don't want Lizzie or Abigail to see you eating it. You think you can do that?"
"Yes."
When Toby gave him the last roll, he gripped it in both hands, holding it up to his nose.
"Don't leave here until I come get you," Toby said, gently guiding his brother back to the alcove.
As soon as Chip was safely tucked away, Toby started the other direction, keeping to the shadows. As he neared the tracks, he saw a wagon stopped just on the other side, a stack of lumber strewn across the rails. Stars faded from the pre-dawn sky, still too early for anyone to be out to help the man who'd spilled his load. The driver seemed unconcerned about moving the wood, instead just sitting there holding the reins of his team as the train approached. Why would someone be moving lumber at this hour? His gaze flew back to the horseman in time to see him lifting a mask over his face. In the distance, on the other side of the tracks, he saw 2 other horsemen, both masked.
"Blimey!"
The train squealed to a stop, sparks flying up from the rails. He glanced at the men, saw the pistols they held. Fear coursed through his veins. He pivoted, about to run off when someone grabbed him from behind, clamped a hand over his mouth, and dragged him beneath the wooden staircase near the corner building. Toby clawed at the hands, trying to squirm free.
"Quiet!"
The man pulled Toby back, his hand so tight Toby could barely breathe.
"You want them to hear you?"
Several terror-filled seconds passed before he realized the man wasn't there to hurt him. He whispered in Toby's ear again.
"I'm going to let go. Not a word, lad. Understand?"
Heart thudding, Toby nodded. The man lowered his hand, and Toby sucked in air, stealing a glance at his captor. Dressed all in black, he was tall, late 20s, a dark bowler covering his brown hair.
"Who are you?"
"Will Sutton," he said. "Been following this gang since last week. Thought they were just after engine parts. Turns out they had something bigger in mind." His blue eyes were focused on the horseman racing toward the stopped train. Toby peered between the splintered stairs as the engineer stepped out from the locomotive, the first horseman pointing a gun at him. The engineer lifted his hands, backing up. The brakeman appeared behind him, his hands going up as well. The other 2 horsemen rode past, stopping 3 cars down, boarding. They climbed to the top of the car, opening a trap door, both disappearing below.
"Interesting," Will said. "I think it would have been locked."
Toby had no idea what he was talking about. His attention was on the first horseman.
"I know him."
"What?"
"That man with the gun. Seen him in the orphanage, I have."
"You're sure?" Toby nodded.
"That's why I followed him."
Will kneeled in front of him, holding Toby by his shoulders, his gaze boring into him.
"Did he see you? Out there in the street?"
"Why, maybe."
He thought about it. Surely the man had been too far away.
"Well, I don't think so."
"If he comes back to the orphanage, make sure he doesn't see you."
"Why?"
The rattle of wagon wheels caught their attention. The driver shook the reins, the team of horses pulling the wagon around to the freight car next to the two waiting horses. The freight door opened and the two men started tossing heavy wooden crates into the wagon bed, each landing with a thud. They followed it with large canvas bags that landed with a metallic ring. When they'd emptied the car, the two men jumped down, then mounted their horses. The wagon driver cracked his whip. The team of horses took off down the street, followed by the two horsemen. The third horseman, the one Toby recognized, watched his men, then turned back to the engineer and brakeman. On the ground. Now! They kneeled, both lying face down near the tracks. The horseman circled the two men, his gun pointed toward their heads. He fired twice. The gunshots cracked, the sharp report echoing off the bricks of the warehouse. Unable to look away, Toby's knees buckled and he sank to the ground. A soft whimper grew louder.
Quiet, lad, Will cautioned.
But Toby wasn't the one making the sound. His brother, the half-eaten burnt roll in his hand, stood in the middle of the street, crying.
Tobe?
The horseman pulled at the reins, whirled his steed about, his gaze landing on the boy. He lifted his gun, aiming. Will swore, darted out. The first shot missed. He grabbed Chip, swinging him around, practically throwing him at Toby as another shot rang out. He stumbled forward, falling to his knees, just a few feet from Toby as the horseman fired again. When he fell forward, he looked right at Toby, mouthing something he couldn't hear. Trapped beneath the staircase, tears welled in Toby's eyes as he gripped his brother's hand, unable to move, transfixed by the dark stain growing on Will's back. Only vaguely aware of the horseman breaking open the pistol, reloading.
Boy,
Will said, his voice a soft rasp. Holding tight to his brother, Toby took a step forward, not sure what to do.
Run!
Chapter 1 Pebble Beach, California. Concours d'Elegance. Present day, August. A salt-tinged breeze swept in from the water, rippling the white canvas tents where spectators stood drinking champagne. Beyond the tents, sunlight glinted off the hoods of the classic cars parked on the newly mowed emerald green grass. Two young children ran between a blue and white 1932 Auburn V12 boat tail and a white 1936 Auburn Speedster, laughing as their parents raced after them, catching their hands then drawing them back away from the cars. Sam Fargo guided his wife Remy out of their path, her attention fixed on the auction book she held. "Anything of interest?" he asked. "Besides very rare cars?" Remy cleared her throat. "It says there's a 1929 Bentley, owned by Lord Albert Peyton, Viscount Wellswick. Please tell me your mother's not expecting us to bid on that." "Of course not." She looked over at him, her green eyes hidden behind dark sunglasses, her auburn hair tucked beneath a wide-brimmed straw hat. "You have no idea why we're here to talk to him, do you?" "I know it has something to do with cars." "That narrows it down," she said, focusing on the program, turning the page. "Viscount Wellswick has three cars listed for auction. Why on earth would he bring them all the way over here when he lives in Great Britain?" "The cars aren't here. He is." She closed the book, taking a look around. "I'm beginning to think he's very rare. Your mother did say he was meeting us at 10. Sam checked his watch. It was nearly 11. "Maybe I got the time wrong." He slipped his phone from his pocket, calling his mother. "Hi, Mom. Did you talk to Albert?" she asked, before he had a chance to comment. "That's why I'm calling. We were wondering if you'd heard from him." "No, but I'm sure he'll be there. I'm at the dock, or otherwise I'd get you the name and number of the motel he's staying at." He heard the sound of a boat engine in the background. His mother, Eunice Libby Fargo, ran a charter boat in Key West for snorkelers and deep-sea fishing. What had been a hobby for her when his father had been alive was now her passion. It wasn't all that long ago that she'd spent more days on land than on sea. Now, in her 70s, the reverse was true, and she wasn't willing to drop anchor anytime soon. "It's possible I got the time mixed up," she said. Any chance you know more about what he's looking for? Just what I told you the other night. Have to go. Taking a group out now. Call me back if you don't hear from him soon. She disconnected. Well? Remy asked. Still a mystery. The only thing he really knew was that, according to his mother, Albert Peyton, the 7th Viscount Wellswick, was a distant relative of his. He's family, and he's in financial trouble, was what she'd told him when she'd called a couple of nights ago, asking if he and Remy could meet with him when they were in Pebble Beach for the Concours d'Elegance. Sam wasn't the type to walk into anything unprepared, but when he'd tried asking her what sort of trouble, she said it had something to do with a car and finances. It was the reference to finances that had bothered him, not that he was about to mention this to his mother. He and Remy were self-made multimillionaires, partly due to Sam's inventions, including an argon laser scanner, a device that could detect and identify mixed metals and alloys at a distance. These days, he and Remy tended to focus most of their energy working for the charitable foundation they'd set up. Amazing, though, how every time an article that mentioned their fortune appeared in some magazine or on the Internet, there was no shortage of friends and relatives who suddenly remembered vague connections to Sam and Remy, hoping for a handout or looking for funds to invest. As much as Sam wanted to believe that someone wouldn't try to get to him through his mother, he knew better. Up until 2 days ago, when his mother had called, he'd never even heard of Viscount Wellswick. Probably not even a real Viscount, Sam said, dropping his phone into his pocket. What sort of British royalty stays at a motel? Remy held up the program. The sort that's forced to sell off cars at auction. Since he's not here now, it's a moot point. Let's just enjoy the day. They strolled across the grass, taking their time to appreciate the vehicles on display. Remy stopped to admire a row of classic sports cars in every hue of the rainbow. It just goes to show that museums aren't the only places that house fine art. These just happen to be on wheels, Sam said. Look at that motor. Now that's a work of art. 630-liter engine, designed by Dr. Ferdinand Porsche, Remy continued. Stop stealing my thunder. Sam was stepping aside for a photographer who was trying to set up a shot of the vehicle with the Pacific Ocean in the background when Remy tapped him on the shoulder. Isn't that Clive Cussler's car? The one he finished restoring in 2010? Sure looks like it. They walked over to the seafoam green car and Sam read the placard. 1948 Delahaye Type 135 Cabriolet. I definitely like the color change, and the saddle brown leather interior works perfectly. The details. He circled the car. The Art Deco detail. That is Art Deco detail, isn't it? Okay, Sam, you can stop salivating. You're like a kid in a candy shop. Who wouldn't be? Every year we come, there's always something new. I have to admit, it wouldn't be August without a trip to Pebble Beach. Sam glanced at his wife, about to comment on how fortunate they were, since Clive always had guest passes waiting for them, when someone near the champagne and refreshment tent caught his eye. A dark-haired man about Sam's age, mid-30s, far too young to be the missing Viscount, watching every move the two of them made. Considering how many people were around, Sam found the man's interest odd. "How about a quick glass of champagne?" he asked. "Before lunch? A bit of an early start to our day." "Yes, well, in this case," he said, taking her arm in his, "we'll need a prop to find out why we seem to be so interesting." "Intrigue? How fun. Who are we interested in?" "There's a man with a yellow shirt and green sweater tied around his shoulders at the far left corner of the champagne tent." "Yellow? Green?" She gave a casual glance in that direction. "Really? If you're going to spy, why would anyone want to wear a color combination like that?" Sam pretended interest in the 1937 Delahaye on their left as they strolled toward the tent. "Maybe he's trying not to look the part of a spy." "Or," he said, leaning down close to her, "he's simply entranced by your beauty and can't take his eyes off you." "Highly unlikely." "The latter, in case you're wondering. Too many far more striking women around here for me to be the center of attention, don't you think? Not in the least, he said, glancing over at his wife. Remy had chosen a Dolce & Gabbana late summer afternoon dress of navy blue and white polka dots, the off-the-shoulder neckline with a gathered sleeve that dropped to her elbow. The three-tiered gathered skirt was mid-calf, and the slightest breeze moved the delicate cotton voile. Perfectly polished red toenails peeked from her white Valentino sandals. Her straw hat matched a shoulder bag just big enough to hold the essentials. Lipstick, comb, driver's license, credit card, phone, carry permit, and a 9mm Sig Sauer micro-compact handgun. You're a knockout, Remy. Always were and always will be. Very wise answer, Fargo. She gave him a dazzling smile, then turned her attention toward the champagne tent. We know he can't be a spy. A what? Government intrigue and world conspiracy? More international jewel thief dressed like that, wouldn't you say? No doubt she was thinking about their last escapade, which sent them to South America, searching for the lost Romanov jewels. Unless he's interested in your wedding ring, he's going to be sadly disappointed. The way the man was watching them from behind one of the tent corners told Sam that he was definitely interested in something about them. He and Remy approached the table where a young woman in a crisp white shirt and black vest poured champagne into flutes. Sam picked up two, handing one to Remy. You take the left, I'll take the right. She lifted her glass and took a sip. See you on the other side. Sam watched as his wife expertly weaved her way through the guests, waiting until she was halfway across the tent, before making his way in the opposite direction toward the man who suddenly found his attention divided between them. When Remy raised her glass in a toast, Sam did the same, and the two closed in. Their target apparently hadn't realized they were zeroing in on him until they were just a few feet away. Sam walked up, clapped him on the back. Wow, didn't expect to see you here. Did you, Remy? Not in the least. The people we run into at Pebble Beach just amaze me at times. The man's blue eyes widened as he looked from Sam to Remy in disbelief. It's you. Considering that Sam expected him to deny any knowledge, or at least pretend he hadn't been watching them, his statement came as a surprise. How do you know us? Of course, I don't know you, he said with a strong British accent. Not personally. You really do look just like your photographs. What luck to run into you straight away. Lucky indeed, Sam said, wondering what sort of game this guy was playing. Didn't quite catch your name. Forgive me, I'm Oliver Payton. But you'll be wanting to talk to my Uncle Albert. Please wait while I fetch him. Right here, Sam said. He and Remy watched the man walk off, Remy saying, Our missing Viscount's nephew? Apparently. Assuming the man really is a Viscount. Your mother seems to think so. She's not nearly as jaded as I am. Besides, how is it I've never heard about him until now? Remy gave him a sidelong glance. Lack of interest in your extended family tree? Only because the branches seem to multiply every time we turn around. Do I detect the slightest bit of cynicism? Don't answer that. She nodded to Sam's left, where Oliver was helping a white-haired man down the slope of rough grass onto a cart path. Our Viscount and his nephew were back. When they reached the champagne tent, the Viscount brushed Oliver's hand from his arm. I'm old, not an invalid. Oliver gave a hesitant smile, clearing his throat. My uncle, Albert Payton, Viscount Wellswick. This is Sam Fargo and his wife Remy. They're here about the car. The old man grumbled something under his breath about the car being his as he turned an accusing glance toward Sam. Suddenly, his expression softened. You look just like Eunice. The last person Sam had ever heard calling his mother by that name was a clerk at the DMV when she'd let her driver's license expire. She'd always hated the name, instead going by Libby, a diminutive of her middle name Elizabeth. She mentioned you were here about a car. Albert nodded. Yes. That you might be interested in the prototype of the Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost.
I don't have a lot of money. I'm not sure the show's the best place for it, but I have a few good ideas on where someone might hide a classic car. I know they're far-fetched, but if you'd only hear me out. Sam and Remy exchanged glances. No doubt a swindle was about to happen, and not a very good one. When it came to cons, Sam liked to let them think they had the upper hand, the better to keep them off guard. You have a card. I'll look into the matter and get back to you. The man's face fell as he patted his pockets. Either he was an extremely good actor, or he'd pinned a lot of hope on that odd speech he'd just given.
No.
I have a mobile, Oliver said. Will that do? Of course. Remy. She handed Sam her glass, then took her cell phone out, entering the number that Oliver recited to her. We'll be in touch, Sam said, placing both glasses on a nearby table. He and Remy walked off, Remy asking, What do you suppose his game was? I'm not sure that he even knows. Sam glanced at the program Remy still held, something about it spurring his memory. Didn't we read a recent article in Sports Car Market about a Viscount selling off a number of classic cars? The same man. Albert Payton, Remy said. While Sam's memory was sharp, his wife had near photographic memory for anything she read. It amazed him how she was able to recall the tiniest details. Downsizing in an attempt to save the family estate. But I don't recall reading that they were selling a prototype Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost. You don't think he was talking about the one that was stolen back in 1906? Of the first ever 4050? They both stopped in their tracks. Sam looked at Remy. We need to find that man. But when they turned back toward the champagne tent, he and his nephew were gone. Chapter 2 It took Sam and Remy a few minutes to find the Viscount and his nephew in the crowd. They'd moved to the other side of the champagne tent, both men looking out toward the ocean.
I don't think they're interested, the younger man, Oliver, said. They just want to think about it. They...
His shoulders fell.
All those families. What do I tell them?
Oliver put his arm around his uncle.
We'll think of something. I promise.
Remy elbowed Sam. He cleared his throat, giving both men time to compose themselves. Mr. Payton. The two men turned, Oliver looking surprised, his uncle looking confused. A few more questions. Sam was about to ask why they'd contacted his mother of all people, when that feeling of being watched hit him a second time. He scanned the crowd, catching sight of a broad-shouldered man with a military buzz cut. The man's gaze slid past Sam as though searching for someone else, waving as he walked in that direction. When Sam turned to see who he was waving to, finding no one, he glanced back, discovering the man had disappeared into the crowd. While it was highly possible the matter was innocent, something told Sam that Oliver and his uncle had been the center of attention. Clearly they needed to learn more from them, but not out here in the open. Let's find somewhere quiet where we can talk.
Lunch, Remy said. I'm starved. Assuming we can get in anywhere.
I'll call the hotel, Sam said. Getting into any of the restaurants on the peninsula was almost impossible during the Concours d'Elegance. As always, Sam and Remy were staying at the inn at Spanish Bay, and that certainly helped when last-minute reservations were needed. He called the concierge desk, glad when Kimberly answered the phone. Sam Fargo, he said, having to move aside when a man intently reading his program almost bumped into him. Any chance you can find us a table for lunch, party of four?
Shouldn't be a problem, Mr. Fargo. I'll just confirm with the restaurant. Please hold.
Sam's gaze caught the man who'd nearly run into him as he walked quickly away, suddenly having a purpose. The moment he met up with Mr. Buzzcut, the same person who'd been watching them earlier, Sam realized it had been no accident. They, or the Paytons, were being followed. Why don't we start wandering toward that shuttle? Sam said to Remy, eager to lose their tail and wondering if there were any more out there. They didn't have to walk far. Kimberly got back to him,
saying she'd secured a table at the taproom, one of the restaurants at the lodge. Drinks ordered, Sam eyed their two guests. My mother was a bit vague about why you needed to meet with us. If you wouldn't mind filling us in. The old man leaned toward his nephew.
Were we looking for him?
Yes, Oliver said. The car, remember?
Quite right. Albert nodded, his attention on Sam.
We thought you'd be the perfect benefactor for my car.
Perfect benefactor, Sam decided, was an odd choice of words. This Silver Ghost prototype that you mentioned?
The same.
Exactly how are you and my mother related?
Do I know your mother?
Oliver smiled at his uncle.
Second cousins, isn't it?
Ah, Cousin Eunice.
Interesting, since Sam's mother had never mentioned this side of her family to him, until this requested meeting suddenly came up. She told me something about a loan, Sam said, trying to get them back on track. What is it you need the money for?
The short version, Oliver said, is that we've lost everything, and we're looking for a loan before they repossess our land and home. We've tried to sell off what we can to get by, but so many make their living off the land they rent from us. Entire families, generations even. We're hesitant to make a deal that might displace them.
When Oliver spoke, Sam's gaze shifted to the door, wondering if the prototype of the Silver Ghost had anything to do with the men he'd seen following them. At the moment, it appeared they'd made it to the restaurant without being tailed. Still, he wasn't about to take chances, and kept watch while they ate. Remy did an admirable job keeping the conversation focused during their meal, the better to evaluate Albert Payton and his nephew. They couldn't rent from the new owners, Remy asked, as the waiter arrived to clear the table. Oliver gave a tight smile, avoiding his uncle's gaze. The one and only offer on the land that we've seen... Well, they've refused to guarantee that they wouldn't evict. Albert gave a firm nod. We are not selling.
The thing is, Oliver said, I don't know how we got to this point. One day we were fine. The next, everything was lost.
He looked at his uncle, then back at Sam. I blame myself. I should have taken over the books sooner. I'm still trying to make sense of it all.
Framed, his uncle said, nodding. They're trying to take everything from me. Everything.
You don't know that, Oliver said.
Don't I?
He looked at Sam, his eyes lucid, sharp. I'll tell you exactly who it is. And why. Chapter 3 The waiter placed a leather folder with the check next to Sam. Albert watched as the waiter retreated, then looked at Sam.
What was I saying?
Someone framed you. He nodded. Whatever thought he'd been about to utter, though, was lost. The older man's memory problems seemed real. That didn't eliminate the possibility that the younger man, no matter how sincere he appeared, was taking advantage of his uncle, or attempting to take advantage of them. Sam directed his attention to Oliver. What is it that you're hoping we can do? Or what is it that my mother suggested we do?
She said you might be interested in using the car for collateral. For a loan.
My mother said that? Oliver shifted in his seat, looking suddenly uncomfortable.
Just enough to help me get his estate back in the black and keep our tenants from being evicted. I'm sure that if I can figure out what went wrong, whatever it was that started this tailspin, we can recover.
Quite my fault, Albert said, looking at his nephew for confirmation. Oliver reached out and clasped his uncle's hand.
He's been a good landlord. I don't think these families could make it if we sold and they had to pay rent at full value.
He looked at his uncle, then back at Sam.
As I said, I blame myself.
Framed, his uncle said again. But any revelations about who was behind it, if anyone, weren't forthcoming. Sam tucked his credit card into the leather folder, handing it to the waiter as he approached. It sounds complicated.
I quite understand if you don't believe us, Oliver said. Sometimes I'm not even sure what's going on. I know Uncle Albert believes someone else is responsible, and I believe him. I've burned through the last of my savings and my sabbatical time. Since I'm out of funds, I have to go back to work. I don't know how else to help him or learn what really happened.
Remy reached over, laying her hand on Oliver's arm.
If what he's saying is true, that someone else is behind this, you should call the police.
My wife is right, Sam said. It's really not something we do.
You hunt treasure, don't you?
That's different.
How?
The actual silver ghost is worth 50 million, if not more. Surely the gray ghost has to have a similar value.
That certainly is the question, Sam said. Where's it been all this time?
During World War II, it was stored away due to the bombing. No one really knew its worth, and there it sat, until we were forced to start liquidating. We'd sold off at least a dozen classic cars when we came across the gray ghost under a dust cover in the barn. When we realized what we had, we contacted Rolls-Royce, hoping to get an idea of the vehicle's worth.
Did they give an approximate value? Sam asked.
That's just it. They said they couldn't place a value, since it was only the prototype.
Only? Remy said, her brows rising.
My thoughts exactly. But then they offered to buy it, saying they'd send someone out to take a look and give an estimate.
Thieves, Albert said. Not going to sell it.
Oliver smiled patiently, saying that was his feeling at the time as well. But they never came out to look. The waiter brought Sam the receipt. He added a tip, then signed it. So no offer.
They never got that far into the conversation. Some other people came out and talked Uncle Albert into entering it into the London Concours, saying it would generate interest and increase the value.
Not sure it should be in a London show, Albert said. Changed my mind.
A bit late, unfortunately, Oliver said. It's entered.
Loud cheering erupted from a group of men at a nearby table, watching golf on a TV mounted on the wall, one of the players making a birdie. When the room quieted once more, Oliver said, Come take a look. See if you think it's worth the collateral of a loan. We can offer a drafty old manor house with comfortable beds and free tickets to the car show next week, where the ghost will be on display.
Other than that,
Sam glanced out the door, but so far no familiar faces. Unfortunately, we have a charity event we're sponsoring in a few weeks. I'm not sure we can fit it into our schedule.
Remy kicked him under the table as she smiled at Oliver. Would you excuse us for a moment? My husband and I need to have a quick look at our calendar.
When she turned toward Sam, her smile was still in place, but he recognized that look. Remy had made up her mind.
Keeper of the calendar, Sam said, nodding at his wife.
He and Remy moved off a few feet toward the maitre d' podium, where two couples dressed for golf were waiting to be seated at a table. Remy stepped past them into the hallway, Sam right beside her, as she asked, Is there some reason we aren't jumping on this?
4 reasons, in fact. First, he wants a loan. We have no idea what the real value is. You realize we could be spending a lot of money for very little return.
Remy made a scoffing noise.
There are more important things in life besides money, which we have plenty of.
She gave a slight nod toward Oliver, keeping her gaze on Sam.
The guy's down on his luck. Selling off family heirlooms to make ends meet, flying all the way out here just to talk to us? If we were ever that desperate, I'd like to think someone would step in and help us. I say we accept.
Your mother apparently thinks the same, or she wouldn't have sent them to meet us.
They probably conned her as well. How is it I've never heard of these relatives before?
Remy crossed her arms.
That's only 2 reasons.
Sam glanced over as the door opened, a cool breeze sweeping across the restaurant. Reasons 3 and 4 just walked in.
Chapter 4
Remy looked over at the two men Sam said had been following them, which furthers my argument that we need to help them.
You're right, Sam said, watching the men from the corner of his eye. So what's our plan to get them out of here without being followed?
You take Oliver and his uncle in the hallway, then downstairs. I'll waylay the buzz cuts and lose them in the hotel lobby. We'll meet outside by the service entrance. I doubt they'll follow either of you while I'm standing so close. And if they do, don't make too much of a mess, Remy. I like coming here.
Funny, Fargo. You're like a bull in a china shop. And that's exactly why I'm leading them on a wild goose chase. So much more subtle than you taking them on, don't you think?
While Remy went to engage the buzzcuts, Sam returned to the table.
Why don't we wait for Remy in the lobby of the hotel? She wants to say hello to some old friends.
Oliver and his uncle looked puzzled, but followed Sam out. When he looked back, he saw the men start toward them, then stop when Remy blocked their way, engaging them as only a woman can. Once out of view, Sam led the Peyton men down the staircase.
"Isn't the lobby on the upper level?" Oliver asked as they trailed him out the door to the parking lot.
"Yes, but we've had a change of plans. We can wait for Remy out here." Sam found a spot near the garbage can's enclosure behind the restaurant. Remy appeared about 5 minutes later.
"Everything okay?" Sam asked.
"Better than okay."
She tossed a key fob in her hand as she led them toward the upper parking lot to a row of Lexus vehicles. And they weren't being followed.
"We have a car waiting for us."
All the Pebble Beach hotels had loaner cars for guest use, but it usually took prior arrangements to reserve one, especially during a busy event like the Concours.
"How'd you arrange it?"
"A woman's wiles.
And some help from Kimberly, who made sure the keys were waiting at the front desk of the lodge." She took a good look around before heading to the white sedan in the middle of the lot. After using the remote to unlock it, Remy tossed the key fob to Sam.
"I thought we could take this back instead of the shuttle, head to the airport in the morning."
"Nicely done, Mrs. Fargo."
He kept an eye on the parking lot as the others slid into their seats. Once everyone was buckled in and they were safely on the road, he looked at the Peytons in the rearview mirror.
"You realize two men have been following you since you've been here?"
"What?"
Oliver asked.
"Why would anyone want to follow us?"
"Hard to say, but between this possible fraud you mentioned and the value of that car your uncle owns, I'd guess it has something to do with one or the other."
"Or both," Remy said.
"That's what we hope to find out."
"So, you'll help?" Oliver asked.
Sam looked over at Remy, then back in the mirror at Oliver.
"No promises yet. Let's wait until I check into things and get a feel for what's going on."
The next morning, after seeing Oliver and his uncle to the airport, Sam and Remy flew home to La Jolla in their jet. Selma Wundrasch, their Hungarian-born researcher, met them at the door. As usual, their German shepherd Zoltan, also Hungarian-born, was beside Selma, his tail wagging in excitement. The dog rushed toward Remy, shoving his nose against her knees as she reached down to scratch him behind the ears.
"I missed you, too," she cooed.
"How was the flight, Mrs. Fargo?"
It didn't matter how many times Remy or Sam tried to get her to use their first names, insisting that she was more family than employee, she'd always reverted back to Mr. and Mrs. In the end, it made her happy, which made them happy.
"Smooth as ever," Remy said.
"Anything exciting on the research front?"
"A few promising leads, but it'll take more time to dig deeper," she said, looking past Remy to see Sam unloading the bags from the car.
"I'll get those, Mr. Fargo."
"After sitting on the plane for a couple of hours, a little exercise will do me good," Sam said as he set the suitcases near the stairs.
"Let's go have a look at what you dug up for us."
They followed Selma to her office, where the overhead fluorescent lights accentuated the subtle pink and purple streaks in her short hair. Selma had always been a bit quirky, wearing tie-dyed shirts that seemed at odds with the rather conservative, dark-framed glasses that usually hung from a gold chain around her neck. The hair, though, was a newer style, one that Remy and Sam noticed Selma had adopted after Professor Laszlo Kemp began working for them.
and she and Laszlo started spending more time together. Sam and Remy had never commented on the matter. They figured Selma would let them know when she was ready, assuming there really was something to the relationship. Her office, where most of the research and assistance happened in the Fargo household, was a large room with state-of-the-art computers. Normally, she worked with two part-time assistants, Pete Jeffcoat and Wendy Corden, who were currently in Africa overseeing a Fargo Foundation project, the building of a self-sustainable school for children that used solar and wind to power the lights and to run the pump for the well. Laszlo was there, however, his chair scooted up next to Selma's desk. His specialty was cryptography, but these days he was a jack-of-all-trades. "Quite the find here," he said, his English accent still strong even though he hadn't lived in Great Britain for years. He was looking at computer screenshots of an old car. "Is that the Grey Ghost?" Remy asked. "The Silver Ghost," he replied. "Doing a comparison. Aside from the names, there are some very subtle differences." Remy leaned in for a better view. "Such as?" "The most obvious being the color," he said, pointing to the screen. "The Grey Ghost being grey." He brought the cursor to the frame of the other photo, bringing it to the foreground, moving it so it was side by side with the Silver Ghost. "The interior coachwork is different. The Silver Ghost has green leather, the Grey Ghost blue. Whether the same or different companies, hard to say until we research further. Back then, it was all bespoke. You picked the company and what features you wanted. No two cars were alike." "So the car's legit?" Sam asked. "Without seeing it in person, it appears so." Selma handed Sam several sheets of paper. "These are what I found on the theft in 1906. Not much on the car after that. Information's a bit sparse." Sam looked through the papers as Selma took a seat at her desk next to Laszlo, pulling out even more papers from a file folder. "These," she said, handing them to Sam, "are what I thought you'd want to see." "What are they?" he asked, handing Remy the first stack before taking the second. "What I think is the real reason behind the theft of the Grey Ghost. It might change your mind about making this trip. At the same time the car was stolen in '06, Selma told Sam, an American agent from the Van Dorn Detective Agency, by the name of Isaac Bell, was in England following a group of criminals responsible for a number of train robberies in America. Apparently, two of the gang members fled to England and joined up with a bunch of thieves and robbed another train, which was carrying a treasure worth about $1 million. "And you think it has something to do with the car?" Remy asked. "It's the only explanation. Isaac Bell recovered some of the stolen treasure as well as this Rolls-Royce they call the Grey Ghost. One of the car thieves was a man named Reginald Oren. But here's where it gets a little muddied." Sam looked up from the papers. "What I'm reading here makes it seem like an early case of corporate espionage." "That was my take on it as well," Selma continued. "Reginald Oren was employed by Rolls-Royce, but he had connections with the gang responsible for the theft of the treasure, and it's not really clear if the treasure and the car were found together." "So maybe someone thinks that missing part of the treasure is hidden in the Grey Ghost," Remy said. "Or maybe a hidden map. It might explain why the Paytons are being followed." "Makes sense," Sam said. "Any idea what part of this treasure is still missing?" Laszlo reached out to acquaintances of his familiar with the local history in England and Manchester just after the turn of the century. "They believe it's around half."
$500,000, Remy said. "The Grey Ghost has to be worth more than that."
"Don't forget inflation," Selma said. 500,000 gold sovereigns from 1906 are worth close to 300 times that much, just for the gold. Close to 150 million.
Remy whistled.
"That car's worth a pretty penny," Sam said. "And about to go on public display," Selma reminded him. "I'm still not convinced that we should involve ourselves," Sam said. "Who's to say the Paytons are on the up and up?" Remy eyed the screenshot of the Grey Ghost, then picked up the phone on Selma's desk, holding it toward Sam.